Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey.
This is our extra credit episode for the month, extra credit episode 007, which is in honor of Roald Dahl's James Bondiness.
Makes sense to me.
Yep.
This is also our video episode of the month. So as you know, we've been doing these unedited live chats. So if you're listening, just know that you can click on the link in the show notes and watch us as well, or watch us instead of listening. You turn down the volume and just watch our faces because we're so animated. Either way, you got three options, just audio, yeah, just visual, or both together. So I want to say,
or put on some music and just watch us talking. Maybe some weird synchronicities will happen.
So much rad stuff. So much rad stuff. I was thinking Floodland by Sister of Mercy is probably the one you're going to watch, and it'll sync up. This will sync up with that album.
With Floodland? I'm going to have to check that out. Well, to kick off the new year, such a random choice. I would think you'd say Dark Side of the Moon.
We thought we'd revisit
for this new one what's happening in Lovecraft Land. You know, it's been a while since we visited there. For the past few months, all people have been wanting to talk about is this Netflix series, Cabinet of Curiosities.
Yes, it is produced by Guillermo del Toro of Hellboy fame, but he's also done Devil's Backbone, which I liked a lot, Shape of Water, Pan's Labyrinth, and of course, the ultimate film, Blade 2.
Oh my gosh, Blade 2. Blade 2. Don't get me started. I really like his movie Kronos from 1992, if you've ever seen that. It's a good vampire movie. To me personally, it's Kronos, Devil's Backbone. I really like Crimson Peak. I don't know if you mentioned that
one. Really? No, I didn't. I didn't know that was... I thought people didn't like it, so I never...
I really like that movie, yeah. But, he can rest on those laurels just from Devil's Backbone and Kronos. I'll watch any of his other movies because they're so beautiful. Sometimes I don't necessarily connect to them. I actually really like Pacific Rim. A lot of people run that one down, but I think it's fun. Right.
Yeah.
It's got giant robots, giant monsters. I mean...
Yeah. It's got it all. But his visual style is beautiful. Like, not... Say what you want about any of his movies, but... They're always amazingly directed art-wise, and they look wonderful, great cinematography, just beautiful pieces of art.
And he writes as well. In fact, I think he was a co-screenwriter on that recent adaptation of The Witches. So he's done a little Roald Dahl work as well.
Tying it around.
This series, though, it's an anthology show in which he's showcasing the work of other directors. I'm sure he did some of them. He participated in the writing, but for the most part, these are other folks making little short horror films.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Now, this series came out last year, and it has two, not one, but two Lovecraft adaptations, Dreams in the Witch House and Pickman's Model, which is what we're going to talk about mostly.
Mostly because those are the only ones of the series that I've watched. I put off watching the show in general. I just had a sneaky feeling I wasn't going to like it.
Sure.
And maybe it's a little of that, you know, when I have time off from work, I don't necessarily want to watch things that are related, but I can say after watching these yesterday, it's confirmed that I don't like it. we had a conversation with Andrew Lehman recently because we're going to do a crossover episode with Voluminous in March.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Announcing that, I guess, for the first time here, but that's coming up, folks. Anyway, we were batting ideas around about that, and he started talking about these, and he was very passionately angry about Dreams in the Witch House. And then we also talked to Dennis Detweiler on a recent bonus episode, and he expressed some of the same opinions, very strong opinions, which I didn't think I was going to have necessarily. I thought the worst thing that could happen is maybe I'd be bored, because I don't think things have to be adapted, you know, to the letter.
Sure, of course.
But after watching them, I get it. I really didn't like these. I felt kind of exasperated.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I really hate running things down. You know, I don't want to brag, but I'm something of a failed filmmaker myself.
Yeah, me too.
I can understand those things. They start one way and then they can turn out another.
Yeah.
These were, as you were talking about his art direction, these were gorgeous episodes of television.
Yeah.
All kinds of neat sets, cool special effects, beautiful costumes. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that the artists who created that stuff got to make neat stuff like that. So I just want to say that, you know, up front, I don't have animosity towards the artists necessarily, but I wasn't a big fan.
Yeah, no, I have to be honest as well. I didn't think they were great, but they weren't terrible. I've seen far worse things. I wasn't bored with them. That's the number one crime I think of any of them. No, I was interested. Things happened that infuriated me at times, or made me throw my hands up, but I'm still watching them. There are other adaptations on there.
Yeah, you watched more of the series.
I did, yeah. I watched the Henry Kuttner Graveyard Rats adaptation. Mm-hmm. We covered that story on our show, so yeah. Obviously it's relevant to us. But I really like that one. It's a bit silly and over the top, but that story is pretty silly and over the top, so I thought it was a pretty faithful adaptation. But they also did a Michael Shea story, which we haven't covered, and I've never read, called The Autopsy. That is my favorite of this whole series. It is really creepy, really great. Again, looks amazing. You know, great acting. F. Murray Abraham's in it. Really good. And maybe it's the, you know, after watching these, that stands out more. And if I just saw it on its own, maybe I wouldn't think. But no, it's got some great Shea stuff in there. It really feels like a Shea thing. So I recommend that as well.
Cool. Well, I'll have to check out those two. Before I watched any of them, I kind of felt like this series would be the equivalent of the horror section in a 90s video store. You know, I got kind of a Cthulhu Mansion vibe from it. I don't know why. Like I just felt like I'm going to watch these Lovecraft adaptations and they are going to meander and stray and just kind of be dumb. And that's what they felt a little more like Clive Barker Books of Blood adaptations.
Sure. Yeah,
both.
I can see that.
But before we get into them specifically, just to say about adaptation in general, it's film is a different medium, TV is a different medium. Likely changes are going to be made when presenting the source material. For me, that's fine. But I think the reason that folks might get angry about this is that this material is being presented to folks who maybe know H.P. Lovecraft's name. They've heard of Cthulhu. Maybe they've heard of Shoggoths or something, but they don't really know what it's all about. And so this is almost like a false presentation of that. It just muddies the waters even more. Because these are so non-Lovecrafty. And I feel like that might be where the anger comes from. Because you have your, say, Conan the Barbarian or Tarzan or Dracula. They're all characters that people might know from pop culture but didn't necessarily read the source material. Mm-hmm. But they have a pretty good idea what those guys are like from the pop culture. Yeah, versus, I don't know what you would think if you didn't read Lovecraft and just came to it from media. And you might think, well, Del Toro is going to be the authority. So I'll watch this Dreams in the Witch House, and that's what that's going to be about. And then there's like a little kid ghost, and you know, it's just not right. But no. I think you wanted to start with Pickman. So I personally watched Witch House first because I'd heard that one was really bad, and I thought, let's get it out of the way. Mm. And then the opening voiceover for it was, don't worry, this has a happy ending. And I thought, oh, they nailed it. They nailed Lovecraft. It's all about happy endings. But we'll come back to that. Let's talk about Pickman's model.
Yeah, so Pickman's model, it's different, and I like different in my adaptations. Sure. But as you were saying, it's got to capture the theme, the mood of the original piece in a way. The particulars, you got to move stuff around because it is a different medium. So I'm open-minded when I'm getting into this. We start off with Pickman and Thurber are in school together, art school together. Obviously, this isn't part of the story. This didn't happen. But Thurber is, in the beginning, painting his girlfriend nude. So we've got some boobs in there. It felt like I was back in the 80s where horror movies just had random boobs in there. Didn't really need it.
It didn't really need it, and it was sort of like opening boobs. It was like, just so you know, usually the opening shot of a show tells you what it's going to feel like, what the texture of the whole piece is going to be. And this one, it was like, here you go.
Here's some boobs. Again, not very Lovecraftian.
And him she called her father, so he had to sort of race out of the her bedroom
window.
Where he was painting his girlfriend, which was very romantic, you know, kind of like a Daniel Steele novel or so. I was just like,
sure.
Where are we? Okay, you're building out this character. I get it. That's cool. He's a
You gotta build out characters of these things.
Sure.
And Lovecraft obviously doesn't have characters really in his stories again, and
I don't know about but let's continue.
Well, anyway, still okay.
Yeah, I disagree.
So, Pickman is at school. He's played by Crispin Glover, people complain about the accent. I know he's doing a New England accent, but then he throws in, it sounds like some kind of Long Island thing that's going on with it as well, which is kind of confusing to me. I don't live up there, so I don't know the accents, especially those accents about 100 years ago, which was. But it was distracting to me, and I think that's a problem. Now, Thurber finds Pickman sketching in the cemetery at night, drawing some screwed up stuff. Pikmin is super talented, but a weirdo. They kind of have this friendship, but it's kind of kept at arm's length because Pikmin's weird. Pikmin explains he's got this family history of witchcraft. His great-grandmother, Lavinia, was a witch, and supposedly she killed her husband and then served him as a meal at the coven meeting. It's this big dinner party.
Yeah.
And the painting of this freaks out Thurber, makes him vomit. So he like goes outside and throws up. And then this carriage comes by, which I thought this is pretty creepy. And there's a dude in there, an older man, breastfeeding off of a woman whose breast is like infected or tainted. It's all like green veins and things in it.
Right.
And then the light turns off in the cab, and then he invites him in, and then smash cut. He's waked up. He's woken up from a dream. So was it real?
That was a very creepy scene. Yeah, I was still on kind of on board at this point. Where are they going with this? And that scared me a little bit.
Yeah.
The lead actor, Ben Barnes, was good, too. I knew him from Westworld, and I think he used to be in a boy band of some sort. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Now, Thurber's having problems. There's a party at his girlfriend's house. He makes a scene. He decides he's going to go to Pikmin to try and figure out what he saw, what's going on with Pikmin, but Pikmin's stuff is just gone. The apartment's totally cleaned out. He doesn't know what happened.
I'd started it losing me at this point because the narrative got weird. I didn't really know what it was. Neat the effect they did when he looked at the painting, how they didn't show you the sum of it. You just looked at zeroed in on a specific aspect to it, and it made it move a little like a motion comic. And it was hurting his head to look at them, and he threw up, and all that stuff was kind of neat. But I didn't really know what is the cost to him and what is it going to drive him to do, or what is it he's really afraid of. And I thought for a horror piece, you really kind of got to know what you're afraid of. I want to know what I'm supposed to be afraid of other than some creepy moments. And so far, it was just unsettling, but I didn't quite get it. Also, the relationship between Thurber and Pikmin was very weak. I mean, he just like called him Dickie, and I guess that was supposed to be shorthand that they were friends, but I expected, and it would be justified by the story, that he would think all the stuff everybody else is doing at school is weak sauce, and he's interested in Pikmin's work and wants to see more of it, and it's pushing boundaries, and he likes that.
Yeah.
Then I would have thought, oh, I get why Pikmin likes him, because this is a true fan, somebody who actually understands his genius. And it just kind of wasn't there.
Yeah. It's sort of there, but not in a way that of any substance.
That's what I did. Why make it sort of? You know, that's what I didn't
get. Yeah. So then this odd thing happens, which I don't know why this choice was made. We jump 15 years into the future, and Thurber's married to his once girlfriend, and they have two kids. He gets a new painting from Pikmin. Pikmin, there's some kind of art competition at the society. Thurber is also an artist. I'm not exactly sure, you know, what this is all about, but Pikmin's in his life again, and there's this new painting. He has a nightmare about that Pikmin painting, comes down, sees that Pikmin had sent him a painting, opens up the painting, and then he freaks out about it again. Of course, he doesn't properly cover it up. His kid comes down and sees the painting.
That's neat. I mean, I liked that. That's like sort of out of the ring where the kid looked at it, and now it's going to disturb the kid. But why this absence of 15 years, and now it's like Cape Fear or something where Pikmin's coming back like, if he'd have done something, if he'd have gotten him shut out of the Art Academy because Pikmin was pushing it too far or something like that. I think with Lovecraft adaptation, sometimes you should just do the story and then extrapolate a little, sort of like they did with the HBLHS Whisper in Darkness, where the story's covered in the adaptation and then build a third act onto it or something of that nature, whereas I didn't even understand why he'd come back, why he was bothering him, why he had any maliciousness towards him. Or was it something like, well, this guy gets me, so I'm going to start sending him my things. They didn't really have a breakup, you know?
No. And we don't know why he left, and it's never really explained.
Yeah.
Now, Thurber keeps having these dreams, and his kid's wigging out now, waking up in the night, being all crazy. There's some wispy smoke in the kid's room, so either he sees it or it's actually there. We don't quite understand.
That was a neat effect.
It was a neat effect.
Thurber, I like whiskey smoke.
Thurber gets a gun, and he goes to visit Pikmin and tells him, stay away from my family. Pikmin says, look, I'll leave you alone. I'll even burn my paintings, but I want to show you my new stuff. And I respect your opinion because you get it. And if you tell me that this stuff is garbage or terrible, I'll burn it all and I will leave this town. You'll never see me again. So Thurber's like, okay. You know, like, Sure, I'll do it.
You didn't really understand why, but okay.
Now, the Pikmin's family house is a mess. It's really falling apart. Pikmin takes him down to the cellar. There's a big hole in it. You know, so we're finally getting to the story here. Thurber sees his paintings and stuff while Pikmin steps out, and he can't take the paintings, so he's going to burn them. He starts throwing kerosene and stuff on them. And Pikmin comes in and says, hey, don't, you know, it's only art. It shouldn't be upsetting you this much. And then Pikmin goes on this rant about the world is madness and my art's just showing things as they really are and people are cruel and blah, blah. Very not Lovecraftian. Not Lovecraftian at all. Like, because he could have been going on a full Lovecraft rant here. None of that. So Thurber shoots him. Pikmin says he paints what he sees, and then we get the revelation that Thurber sees that there's actual photographs.
So it was in there.
Yeah, family photos. It's in there. Thurber throws a lamp. It sets the whole place on fire. A ghoul comes out of the hole and drags Pikmin into it. Not your Lovecraft ghoul, not canine-like, which is what I always want to see, because I've never seen that in stuff.
Yeah.
But it's got long arms, really big eyes, and it has this spiky sack under its chin, kind of like a frog or a pelican, which, you know, it's weird looking. But
it was a weird monster. I like weird monsters, but this is a time when you do have something in the text to work from, and why not do it? Why not realize it when you have the tools? I didn't.
Lovecraft actually drew this specific monster. He drew it.
Yeah, there's a sketch.
So it's like, come on. But I guess they didn't like that sketch. Thurber runs off.
I don't get it.
At the end, he goes to the art gallery, and I guess Pikmin stuff has been put on display for some reason. The guy from the gallery has jabbed one of his own eyes out, and he's totally talking crazy talk. Then he goes, and for some reason, his wife and his kid are in the gallery. They've seen the stuff. They seem okay at the moment, but when he gets home, his wife has gone nuts. She's poked out her own eyes, and she has cooked their son for them to eat.
What?
The end.
And there's like some elder signs that people are scraping into their head.
Yeah.
So they're like waiting for some glorious something to happen. It made no... I mean, it just turned into a gross out.
But it wasn't even Lovecraftian.
And I didn't understand it. No, it wasn't.
It didn't have any of the old gods. It didn't have any of that stuff. It was just about witches and cannibalism and the darkness inside of people and blah, blah, blah.
And this was the good adaptation.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, okay. I'm going to defend this one a little bit. But there's a point where I just was completely... I was on board at first. Okay, so...
At first I thought, okay, yeah.
Okay. So this is Dreams of the Witch House. It's got Rupert Grint, who is better known as Ron Weasley, as Walter Gilman. Now, when Walter was a kid, we have an early flashback. He's got a twin sister that's ill. She's died right next to him.
Oh,
and then
whatever.
Her ghost shows up. Her ghost gets dragged away into the woods, but it's not the real woods. It's like the bushes open up into another dimension. You find out later it's called the Forest of Lost Souls.
Oh, no. I was just going, oh, no.
Again,
he's a ghost.
Not really Lovecraft. But I was still open-minded because I thought maybe this is like some interdimensional stuff that was going on here. I don't know.
Oh, boy.
Now he's grown up. It's the 1930s, part of the Spiritual Society, and he's looking for psychics, for real psychics. So he's going to these shows hoping they're going to be real. Turns out they're all charlatans. Again, I kind of like this stuff. It was really neat. It's all period. The stage stuff that was going on was really neat. The guy was a good showman. He's got his buddy there, this guy Frank, who's also in the society, but he's not a true believer. He's just sort of interested in it. And he's leaving the society because they're not making any money. The society's not making any money. He's going to get a job at Time Magazine. So,
It was funny that the Spiritualist Society, again, I agree with you. This was interesting stuff. And I felt like Catherine Hardwicke maybe wanted to more make like Enamorata, that novel, or something that was about these spirit mediums.
Yes.
And busting them. You know, there's a whole Houdini's Angels thing that I think would be a great project that would be along these lines.
Yeah.
You know, Houdini had these people that would go bust spirit mediums, and Nia Vardalos played the spirit medium here. She just sort of had a cameo, who's famous for My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
All right.
And that was that ectoplasm thing with the paraffin that she was using. These are all cool, like real things that spiritualists would do at the time. She used to be married to Ian Gomez, and they both were in the Second City. And when I was a driver for a brief time in Chicago, I drove them to an anniversary dinner once, and she was very nice to me. That was before she became huge and famous. So got to see her, and I was like, oh, cool, she's in this. So there was something redeeming about it for me.
There you go.
But it was funny, the Spiritualist Society is that institution that eventually is going to be pushed back upon. Like, they're the ones that are like, you've gone too far, Ron Weasley. It was like, what? Why make the crackpot, you know, Spiritualist Society? They're going to be the ones that are going to be on board with whatever. I didn't get that. But it felt like maybe she wanted, the director wanted to be making something different.
Yeah. I could see that. Now, Walter works at a bar to make ends meet. He overhears some Native American guys talking about other dimensions. And he goes, hey, look, I've seen some stuff. And they're like, okay, we got something for you. They take him to this opium den-like place, give him the stuff, which is called liquid gold, that allows him to visit the forest, the lost forest of souls, the forest of lost souls, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
And he's able to see his sister.
It's people just seem to have the information that he needs. I like that there were two just Native Americans hanging out in the bar, like talking about crossing over to dimensions, having a beer, you know. And then immediately we're like, well, if you want to know, you got to come get this Acapulco gold over at the, I mean, liquid gold was making me laugh. Good job on that one. It did give, I chuckled pretty hard when he came to the Spiritual Society. He's like, there's this thing called liquid gold and you got to try it.
Liquid gold is oil. By the way, that's
sure.
a common phrase. That isn't the Beverly Hillbillies theme song.
Yeah.
Liquid Texas gold, tea. Texas tea. Okay. So, yeah, this all seemed weird and awful.
And he's playing it. I mean, I think that this guy is a good actor. And all the performers in these were fine. And it's just like what they're being instructed to do. But he was at that pitched level of insanity, like the whole time. Like, you've got to believe me, you know, that there were no levels at all. His character started that way. And, remained that way.
Intense, very intense.
Both of the shows.
I like the motivation that this particular character had a personal connection to it, and he was motivated. Like, he had a good motivation because he was trying to find out what happened to his sister because it wigged him out.
X-Files motivation. Yeah,
sure, but it's still something. It doesn't feel very Lovecraft. There could have been ways to do that where it could have been more Lovecraftian, like if some weird stuff happened with her
But it was an unnecessary thing to do. Okay, well,
let's roll through
the rest of this.
Yeah, I'm going to go through quickly.
Yeah, because we don't need... I mean, it was a crazy show, so a synopsis isn't going to make much sense.
Well, I just want people to know, because I don't necessarily want to watch it or didn't
because I heard it was bad.
So I feel like it's important to let people know exactly what this is, and then they can, if they want to, then they can watch it. Now he tries to go to the Spiritual Society, and his buddy Frank, they all think he's nuts. He's taking drugs from strangers, which I kind of have to agree with him. Always know your dealer, folks. It's very important. in the house, there is a lady who has visions about Keziah Mason, a painter, and about Brown Jenkins. And he hears about this house and that it's maybe has some real from the Supernatural Society, that there's something really supernatural going on. She went to it previously. So he goes, you know what, looks up Keziah Mason, finds out she had this whole interdimensional thing too going on. So he's like, I'm going to go to this house. Right when he goes in, we see Brown Jenkins immediately. He's very creepy. He's got a little face, which is for some reason even kind of creepier than having a big rat with a human face. So I thought he was pretty good. He skittled around. He did some stuff. And Keziah is represented as kind of a Puritan woman, but she looks like she's made of wood and that her hair is on fire and she's got like light flame eyes. Kind of creepy, but again, it's not. It doesn't feel
Lovecraftian. I thought super neat when she was first creeping about and you didn't get a full view of it, and they treated it like a prop. They were just kind of moving with the burning eyes in it. It had a really nice feel. And I was surprised that you've got a rat with a human face and you don't tease that out a little longer. I mean, I'm familiar with the story, so when I saw it, I wasn't surprised in the least. But if you didn't know this, they just show it. The rat moved rat-like and was creepy and gross, and I liked the computer animated model, but like they just revealed it and he had a total Boss Baby vibe going on, you know. He very much felt like that baby, you know, the mobster trying to pretend to be a baby from the old Looney Tunes. Yeah. That was the vibe I got from him, which is so not creepy. I don't think of that familiar as being the comedy relief of Dreams in the Witch House yet.
No.
It was Brown Jenkins' voiceover where he said, "Don't worry, it's all got a happy ending," in some accent that I couldn't understand as well.
Yeah. So Walter takes the liquid gold in the house. This allows somehow to get him in there to get his sister, but then Keziah is also able to come into the land of the dead, and then he pulls his sister out, but she's still a ghost. So we've got like ghost sister as a character, and obviously this is really where I got lost, because I'm like, wait, she's like in the gang. It's like a superhero team or something, you know, like
she's like a little ghost in her pajamas. He put his hand through her initially, but she's able to stand on floors. And then later he does able to, I didn't understand what was going on.
Well, just that it's like the antithesis of weird anything. She's just a ghost girl now. She's like Casper, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's
pulled her out of the dream, like Freddy Krueger.
Like Freddy Krueger. So they go to the painter lady who's also living in this house. And she says, "Look, your sister can come back to life, but somebody's got to die to do it." And they're like, "Oh, so that's what Keziah is up to. She's trying to kill me so that she can take my life or whatever." So they go, "Okay, what we got to do is we're going to go to the nun. And my sister," I'm not sure if it's actually her sister or if it's just a nun that she calls sister, because nuns are called sisters, so I'm not sure. But they go in there. There's a whole kind of like Evil Dead thing where Keziah is trying to get into the church. And it pulls him out like by some unseen force. And it's like, what's going on? Why is this happening? There was a total change that I cannot forgive this thing for, where there's a joke. There's two jokes in there where there were zero jokes in the whole thing. All of a sudden, the nun says, "You gotta don't mess up my floors." And you're like, what? Yeah. What? That's terrible. And then later on, she says, "Try and get her, mofo, or you effer." And I'm like, the nun swearing, get the F out of my church, something like that. And it's just like, oh God. Then I was really not on board, but then I was out. I was done. And I'm like, but so I sat through the rest of it. The sister goes and saves her brother. Keziah is destroyed. They don't explain how this works. It just does. Keziah is destroyed. And he's okay. She realizes she doesn't need to hold on anymore, and she's able to move on to the next world. And then he passes out on the floor. Brown Jenkins runs up to him, but you see a cut. He's in bed feeling sick. Frank and the painter are there. Oh, he's going to make it through the night. My visions were wrong. Great. And they leave the room, and then out of his chest pops Brown Jenkins, which was in the story. They go up because there's dripping on the floor, and they find the body of Brown Jenkins and the body of Keziah up in the attic, which is again from the story. I'm just give it some credit that is from the story.
That's true.
But the bones of Brown Jenkins disappear, and after they leave and see Brown Jenkins' rat goes back into his body. Why did it leave? I don't know. Into his body and kind of remote controls Ron Weasley around, and he's like, I'm free. I can go do my stuff in this human body for a while. This is great. Da-da-da-da-da-da. And that's the end.
Oh, man.
So I can see why people didn't like that.
Yeah. It's not. Well, look, it wasn't entertaining to watch. So
no,
I can forgive a little bit of derivation. But, you know, I remember when I hadn't seen it yet, and when Andrew was talking about it, he said, "Look, if you want to make that movie. Just don't call it Dreams in the Witch House. It has nothing to do with that." And that's, I agree. It's, you're doing a disservice to
the
author and the story. A very cool story. And
one of the coolest things about that story is the mixing of science and magic. You know, like that he is a mathematician, and all this weird magic stuff. He's like, wait, this works with math. Like, what's going on here? So that's some cool, mind-blowing, rad stuff that is totally ignored in this story.
It's just not in there at all. No.
At all. And that's like one of the coolest things about that story. And of course they drop the ball on that. And then they make it I think you're right. It felt like she wanted to make something else and kind of bent this to try to fit into the other thing that she was doing.
I think it's entirely possible. I didn't read much about the production of these things and the backstory and all that. And not, sure if I'm that interested. And a lot of times it's hard to get the real story anyway. But she's a good, I like her. She's made some cool movies. I know people are like, oh, she made Twilight. But to me, that's just a job. All like, right. I really liked her Red Riding Hood movie. I thought that was, it looked beautiful. And she made 13, which I thought was a killer movie. And so, you know, right. I think she's a really talented director. My guess would be Del Toro picked the slate, then picked directors. So she got that because he's got a screenwriting credit on this, I think. So probably he had a draft or some take on it, and that's what she got. Yeah. And so it's like they're not going to check on her work,
sure,
you know, to see if it fits. So we just got what we got. And this was her attempt to make it something that she would be interested in. You can kind of see those hallmarks of their baking in a backstory that, you know, a lot of horror movies, I feel, when they don't really know where they're going, end up introducing the theme of you've got to move on. Especially ghost stories where there's some tragedy that the main character experienced and they're stuck in that stagnation of grief and the ghost or the spirit or whatever helps them move on. And so they were kind of trying to do that in here. The ghost was like, I'm not scared anymore.
Yep, yep.
But it's like that story doesn't belong with what you described, which is the intersection of math and magic and how something from the antique world can relate to, you know, something hyper mathematical. And that's neat enough. There's,
oh my God. Yeah.
The problem with adaptation in general often is that invention when there's your job is to take that, as I see it, to take that source material and take what's good about it and make it work in that medium. So sometimes there's big differences, like in the like Kubrick's The Shining. When I read that book finally, I was like, wow, these are actually pretty different stories in some key ways. And I think that's why Stephen King wanted to do another adaptation of it later. But nevertheless, I'm not mad at that adaptation. It did build on what was already scary in the book and then take it some new direction. So it mined what was already there, whereas these things both seem to kind of just ignore the source material. And it's like when we're, you know, you're talking about any other nerd thing where you go, I think that they don't like this character. I think that the artist got assigned this, don't like the character or don't understand the character, so just went, let's do it this way. And for those that do really like that character, it's like kind of offensive.
But I argue with it. Gilman doesn't have much of a character in that story. He's just a student and he is trying to figure some stuff out. So to give him some kind of personal motivation, you know, I think that, but why is it the spiritualist thing? It would have been interesting if he was into science. He was like, I'm going to use science to figure out what happened to my sister. Like, why wasn't that part of that motivation? Because that is so, again, the cool part of that story is that this, what we see as magic isn't really magic. It's just a hyper understanding of the way the universe works. And it's horrific. It's this terrible thing. And there's these horrible things that live out there and are malevolent and or indifferent. And, you know, all the cool Lovecraft stuff, which is what you should be getting. If you've given somebody a chance, like, this is the first time that they're ever going to see anything by Lovecraft, you better have that stuff in there because you want them to go, wow, that was neat. I want to read some of this. I want to read this book. And I don't anybody's going to watch this and go, oh, I want to read that.
No. Or they'll read it and they'll go, oh, it wasn't what I expected. I thought there's going to be, you know, a woman cutting carrots who pulled her eyes out. You know, it's just like the wrong thing. And I feel like you have to represent the thematic stuff correctly.
Yeah.
So even if you take plot, because a lot of times I think there's a certain, it's almost like from the Call of Cthulhu RPG where there's affectations that these things do. So they're set in the 20s, like people are dressed right, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or they have the jazz age kind of lingo or something, or there are tentacles.
Sure.
You know, or there's an octopus somewhere. It's like, got it, did it. We're Lovecraftian now. No, that's not what is cool about that stuff. I was afraid. I wanted to come back around to these for the bonus episode because people have been talking about them a lot. And when I said, let's do something Lovecraftian to kick off the year, I mean, what else were we going to do? So I was glad to talk about them. But I also, like I said, I don't really like running things down.
No.
Especially
no,
if they're not enjoyable in a fun way. This wasn't really good B-movie stuff.
No, not at all. It wasn't ridiculous to the point that it was amusing. It was just not not good and miss the mark. And it really, especially for us, because we're so close to the source material, you really want it to convey those great ideas of cosmic horror and what is really Lovecraftian, which it failed, both of those failed to do. And that's disappointing. You know, when I think about things like Game of Thrones, when that was on, that was so good that people were like, I want to read those books. The show's not giving me enough.
Oh, sure.
I want more. And you hope that there's going to be a Lovecraft adaptation that does something like that, that makes people go, ooh, whoa, this is great. I want more. I'm going to go read those books right now because I can't wait for another year for another production to come out. I need it right now. So this is not that. Is what I'm trying to
say. Yeah, and it had a chance to be, because I think even still it's in the top 10 on, I mean, people are watching this series.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But that Autopsy, though, I gotta say, I really dug that, and it does feel like a Shay story.
Yeah.
I haven't read that particular story, but they touch on the cosmic horror. You get some serious cosmic horror stuff in that, which
That's
you don't
great.
In the Lovecraft ones, which is crazy.
Okay, well, I'll watch that one.
So, yeah, I want to thank you guys. You guys are high-end supporters for supporting us. Hopefully this is okay. You guys like doing the video stuff. And if you don't, let us know, and we'll stop doing it. Because we're doing this for you.
Pull the strings.
Yeah.
Well, it's also fun to be able to have a look at you once in a while, Chris. You look good.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, you too. Hey, you look great.
Thanks, man. That's what this is really all about. Well, that's all we have for Extra Credit 007 here at Strange Studies and Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you can find us exclusively on Patreon.
Boom!
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.